Hello, everyone, and welcome to A Cast of Kings, an unofficial podcast about the HBO original series Game of Thrones. I'm David Chen, and I've never read any of the books in George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
My name is Joanna Robinson. I've read every book in George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire.
And welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. So if you're just tuning in to A Cast of Kings for the first time, find more of our episodes at gameofthronespodcast.com. You can also email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. That's acastofkings@gmail.com. What we do here on the podcast is we discuss everything through this week's episode of Game of Thrones. We spoil everything. But we don't spoil anything from future episodes. That includes anything from the next time on preview that HBO shows. That also includes anything from future books or future book developments that Joanna happens to know really intimately. So nothing is spoiled for people who only watch the show, which are people like me. And we will just talk about everything through this week's episode. So one other thing I wanted to announce before we begin today's episode, and that is we have a lot of new listeners. Every single time the show starts up again, there's a renewed amount of interest in Game of Thrones podcasts out there. So a lot of people downloading some of the older episodes of the show and catching up on the podcast. So first of all, thank you guys so much. We really appreciate you guys dipping back into the archives. And, do feel free to check out those episodes. Leave us a review on iTunes if you like it. You can also follow us on Facebook. There's a nice little Game of Thrones community going on there at facebook.com/acastofkings. That's facebook.com/acastofkings. No spoiler zone in the Facebook page, so no spoilers for that page. But feel free to discuss, the weekly goings-on on the Facebook page. Really appreciate it. And it's always a lot of fun to see what people think about the show there. So, Joanna Robinson, we got a few emails from our last episode where we did a preview of this season.
We did.
Let's see. You can always email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. And let's see. What are we going to talk about here? Well, one email that I wanted to mention was AdamX6000 writes in, was there a reason why they couldn't just kill off Dario Naharis or replace him with a new character if they couldn't get the same actor for season 4, unless the character that is already written or blueprinted by George R.R. Martin is very intricate to the plot of Game of Thrones? It makes no sense to confuse the audience with a new actor for an old character in an epic, convoluted story that is already asking a lot from their audience. So, Joanna Robinson, we got some comments about our discussion. Obviously, Dario Naharis has been replaced this season.
Right.
And I think, actually, did we talk about how the reason was because he is that actor, the original actor, I think, is going to be the new transporter?
Yeah, he's playing a younger version of Jason Statham.
Yeah. So, I don't know. Like, me personally, if I had to choose between a new transporter and Game of Thrones, I don't know that I would have made that choice. But whatever, he did, and so they have to get a new actor. So when we talked about it, we kind of made it seem as though like the showrunners got rid of him, but it's very likely more complicated than that. Do you think that's fair to say?
Well, yeah, but how interesting that they would only have him under a 1-year contract.
Right.
You know.
Curious judgment going on there. Curious judgment. Anyway.
This is what I think about every time an actor like wants to leave a show mid-season, like it happened on Justified this year and Sons of Anarchy earlier in the year. And I'm just amazed that there aren't contracts in place to prevent that, because then you have to do weird, story rejiggering or recasting in order to compensate for it.
Yeah. So, it's the fans that suffer, Joanna Robinson. The fans who are like, what is going on? Who is this character that just appeared out of nowhere? To be fair, that kind of stuff happens all the time in highly regarded shows where, like, remember, have you seen The Sopranos yet? Are you caught up with The Sopranos?
No, I haven't.
Okay. Well, in season 3 of The Sopranos, there's a major character that's introduced, like, very sort of off the cuff. This kind of stuff happens all the time. So it's just kind of weird, but it is weird that it's like, there was no, fanfare for the new actor. Like, they just kind of assumed that you'd know it was the same dude. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I think they did write it in because they had that whole sequence where she's like, where's Dario Naharis?
Right.
Where is he? And they lead him around and they're like, here he is. This is him. He looks just the same. Can't you tell?
I don't know, Joanna Robinson. I think if I had, like, been watching and we hadn't had our pre-show talk, I would have been really, really confused. So
I wrote a post about it on Vanity Fair, and it did it got disproportionate traffic just because I think people were very confused, and rightfully so. But you know what I do appreciate is I feel like they cast the actor, not the look. And actually, I think that's ultimately going to be the better decision. They could have cast someone who looked more like Ed Skrein, I think is the name of the former actor.
Right.
Or even styled this new actor to look more like him. But I like his new look, and I like this actor quite a bit. So I think in the long run, it's going to be a plus for the show. I just think that it's going to be confusing for right now.
Yeah. All right.
But that's why stuff like this podcast exists, right?
Exactly. So there you go. All right. Well, let's dive into this episode. You can always email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. Keep those emails coming, and we'll be getting to some more of your emails later on in this episode. So it's been a year since Game of Thrones, and we have a cold open, right, which is the sequence that plays before the opening credits. And if I recall correctly, John Robinson, like a cold open is relatively rare in Game of Thrones, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, like there have been a few cold opens. The pilot had a pretty fantastic cold open.
Yes.
But not that many cold opens in general. So I think it's notable that we had a cold open here. And it was a fantastic cold open. No words at all. Now, explain to me which sword this was. I want to say it's Robb Stark's sword or Ned's sword. Is that correct?
It's Ned's sword, yeah.
What was confusing about this scene is right after sort of the previously on Game of Thrones. So they like showed all this random stuff on the previously on Game of Thrones, right? The guy who becomes the court fool, right? They showed that scene. It's like, why are they showing that? And of course we know that's gonna come back later on in the episode. But what was really confusing was they showed Ned beheading the dude in the first episode of the series. And then they show Ned getting beheaded, and they show like the sword like bloody with blood dripping off it, and it almost made it seem like that sword that was used to behead Ned is the one that they melted down in the opening scene, which I don't think is true. Is that right?
No, it is true.
It is true. Okay, so How did that sword get into Robb Stark's hands after?
It's not Robb Stark's sword.
Okay, it's just Ned's sword.
Yeah,
and they just waited this long to melt it.
Yeah.
Why did they wait until now? Do you have any sense of that?
I don't know.
Okay. Okay. So, yeah, that was mildly confusing. But, okay, that makes sense. So they used Ned's sword to behead him, and then they melted it down.
Right.
So the previously on made complete sense then. And it's an
I think what confused some other people is they pull it out of sort of like a wolf pelt sheath. Right. And I think a lot of people thought that was like Rob's dire wolf or something like that. But it wasn't. It was just the sheath of the sword. So.
I see. But there was a wolf pelt that Tywin threw into a fire. And,
exactly.
And that was Robb's direwolf?
It's just that Ned's sword was in a wolf skin sheath.
I see. Okay. All right. So it was just totally Tywin just chose a totally convenient time to melt down the sword, I guess.
I think it has to do with Jaime coming back, and wanting to give this to Jaime.
Fair enough.
But Ned's sword is called Ice. And so the show opened with ice and fire, I guess you could say. And the musical cue, you're usually more adept at picking this up than I am, but the musical cue I really liked in that because it started with the Stark theme with the Reigns of Castamere just sort of slow playing a little bit under it.
Right.
And then it got hardcore into
the Reigns of Castamere.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I remember that. That was really, really awesome stuff.
Yeah.
So fantastic cold open, really effective. And then we get the opening credits again, which are still breathtaking after all these years. There were a couple of places that were shown in the opening credits. Now, theoretically, they show you the opening credits to sort of orient yourself and get acquainted with what we're going to see this episode. But there were a couple of locations that we didn't actually see in this episode. Am I right about this, right?
Well, I think they've shown locations that they don't show in the episode.
Correct.
Correct.
Yeah. Usually it's locations that they're at or that are mentioned. Dreadfort was shown, the place where Theon is. That's not... they don't show any of Dreadfort in this episode, as far as I know. Meereen, is it?
Yes.
So they don't. I don't think they actually make it to Meereen in this episode, but they're obviously heading there. Right. So we'll get to that in a little bit. Then we see Jaime Lannister have this conversation with Tywin about. Let's talk about all the King's Landing plot lines right now. So
okay.
So Jaime Lannister has this conversation with Tywin. They want to. He wants to continue being a member of the Kingsguard. Kind of interesting that he still wants that, seeing as how no one else seems to want that. I mean, I am curious, like, what Jaime's motivation is for wanting to remain in the Kingsguard. I would surmise that it is sort of his attempt at, you know, getting back to normality after his traumatic journey. But I don't know if you have any insight into that, Jonah.
According to this episode, he says it's the only way he can stay near Cersei, because otherwise he would have to go to Casterly Rock.
That's right.
Basically.
Yeah.
So he wants to have a reason to stay at King's Landing and be near Cersei and protect Joffrey, even though Joffrey is a monster. He's his son. So, you know, it's part of it.
Right. But yeah, Tywin wants him to go back to Casterly Rock, and he is not into that at all. Jaime and Cersei have this pretty tense scene that I thought was a little interesting. I mean, the only thing that wasn't said in that scene was Jaime saying, "Are you breaking up with me?" he didn't say that, but that's kind of the subtext. And Cersei never has a chance to answer him. But it seems like that quote-unquote relationship is not going well.
Yeah, she did say that he came back. You know, I guess she's harboring a lot of resentments. She feels abandoned. And she says, "You came back too late."
So here's a question, if I may ask, if you to recall from earlier episodes, what was the sequence of events that led to Jaime being away from Cersei? I mean, he attacked Ned's men and, you know, Ned, and then that was in season one. And then I don't recall how he got out into the middle of nowhere.
Well, then there was a war.
That's
a
right.
War was declared basically between the Starks and the Lannisters, so he went to fight the war.
Right. As opposed to – but I guess what I'm saying is, did he have the option of staying staying back and kind of
– Not really. I mean, given like that he's such a known fighter,
right.
I think it would have looked insane for him to stay out of it.
Basically, I'm asking Joanna Robinson, was Cersei being a reasonable girlfriend?
Or was she sister?
Was she being too demanding? That's kind of what I want to know. And it sounds like, I mean, what do you think? Do you think she was being too demanding? It sounds like, based on what you're saying, that she was.
I don't know. The context is so hard to put it just in, like, are you being a demanding girlfriend? I mean, I think it was, she might have had a point that he shouldn't have started a fight with Ned Stark in the street. That was probably the more debatable decision that he made. I don't
right,
think he
which,
really had
which,
a chance once the war started. You know?
But that decision precipitated the war in some ways, did it
right,
not?
Right?
Like, if he hadn't killed a bunch of Ned's men, then...
If he hadn't pushed Bran Stark out a window, you know? You can trace the start of the war back to a bunch of different places, but
right.
Bran Stark going out that window is a pretty tidy starting point.
Let's actually trace that. So Bran Stark goes out the window, and then what happens as a result of that?
Bran Stark goes out the window.
So then he gets incapacitated, and then Catelyn Stark thinks that Tyrion tried to have him assassinated.
Right.
Right. And then so then she takes him hostage, and then brings him to her sister, and they go through their shenanigans, and
right.
That ended up causing more problems for the Starks.
Right.
Basically.
Right.
So, yeah, I guess if he had just waited a few more days for them to sort of consummate their relationship, we might not be in this mess right now. And Ned Stark might still be alive.
Yeah. So. If they hadn't had to have sex in that tower at that moment.
Yeah.
A lot of people might still be alive.
Yeah.
But
we all know what that's like. You know, sometimes you got to do it, you know?
Well, and I mean, Cersei is a villain. She's a terrible person. But at the same time, I did like her speech because she's like, well, this is what happened. My boyfriend/brother left and got captured. you know, my husband is dead. I mean, personally, I think she had something to do with that, but like, my husband's dead. my son's an asshole. My daughter, who I love, was shipped off to Dorne. Like, you know, she's had a rough, you know, and the castle was under siege. She has had a rough time. She's still a terrible person, but right. She's had a rough time as a terrible person. So,
right. So, we should say that they get interrupted, like she's about to quote unquote break up with him, and then they get interrupted by one of Cersei's spies, who it looks like has finally figured out what's going on with Tyrion and Shay.
Right.
Is that your take on it? Right. So we don't know what's going to happen with that, but it feels like not good things are going to come as a result of that. I don't know. It didn't really feel like that woman, her spy, like saw that much, in my opinion. But
I think she heard shouting.
Fair enough.
Shay was being pretty loud, so she didn't see much, but she heard things, I think. So,
got an email from Ian from Atlanta at acastofkings@gmail.com, and he wanted to ask me, Dave Chen, how I felt about the introduction of Oberyn Martell. I'm going to quote from the email. I thought the introduction was perfect from a casting, writing, and acting standpoint, but I'm wondering if viewers like Dave are still interested in meeting new faces, as it were. Dave, did you enjoy the introduction of Oberyn, and are you excited for what the character might mean for our existing plot lines, or do you feel like they just started spinning another plate? So we meet Oberyn Martell, and this is it was supposed to be the prince of the House of Martell, right? That was supposed to come?
Both princes, but it was supposed to be the crown prince.
Yeah. The crown prince, and he is sick, so Oberyn comes in his place, but apparently Oberyn is way more violent. That's the one thing that I didn't really understand about this episode is, so Tyrion seems like way more concerned that Oberyn is here versus his brother, but wouldn't his brother have the same grievances as Oberyn?
It's like, more that it's a slight. It's a diplomatic nightmare. If you invite Prince William, you know, current Prince William in England to come and Prince Harry comes instead, that's an insult because a second son is not as good as the crown prince.
Fair enough.
You know? And Oberyn has a reputation for being a good fighter and a hot temper. And so like his brother might have the same grievances, but he's a more mild tempered person. And Oberyn is hot blooded. So it's an insult and he's like a wild card. And since it's Tyrion's job to be diplomat and handle the situation, it's a very tough diplomatic position to put him in.
Right. That makes sense. That makes total sense. I mean, I'm just curious, like what would the actual crown prince of House Martell have behaved like? Would he have been equally belligerent? It sounds like the answer is no.
No, but he like his
way of like being a dick was not going at all.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Exactly.
What did I think of Oberyn Martell? I mean, I think this is about as good as character intros get on this show or any show. It was a really remarkable intro. I mean, you start by having him in the brothel, Baelish's brothel. Baelish, we don't see this episode, by the way. Presumably he's Littlefinger is what I'm thinking of. I apologize. Where is Littlefinger? He has possession of what place again? He was given last season, right?
He went to the Eyrie.
The Eyrie.
To sort of go woo. Baelish and Littlefinger are the same person.
So I'm sorry. Yeah, right. I knew that as well, but I don't know why I implied they were different.
That's okay. but he went. The last we saw, he went to the Eyrie to go court Lysa Arryn, who is Catelyn's sister, who we talked about earlier.
Right.
Yeah.
So, Lord Baelish is away. We don't see him this episode, but his brothel is still in full operation. And we see this really kind of – like we've seen all manner of nudity and breasts on this show. But yes. I felt like they were – like the prostitutes on the show, the women on the show, were rarely as dehumanized as they were in this scene with Oberyn. I don't know how you felt about it. Like I just it was really and when I say that, this is not our usual ranting about like
right.
the nudity of the show. Like I'm saying I thought this is a really effectively done scene that used the nudity really well, where you're just evaluating these women like pieces of meat. And he was doing it in such a heartless way. It was totally sort of sex as I don't know if a weapon is the word I want to that I'm looking for, but more like sex as a way of establishing dominance, right?
I could see that on the one hand, but on the other hand, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
That wasn't 100% my interpretation of the scene, because I thought he was actually being kind of kindly to them, as different than we've seen them treated by other customers in the brothel. And they were talking about personality. They weren't just like too round, too short, too tall, whatever. It's like timid, adventurous. I like her. Like, personality was involved, not just like judging them as pieces of meat. Not to say that any yeah. any.
I guess. I mean, you're
no,
right.
Not to say that any like brothel we're picking out a prostitute to enjoy together scene isn't going to be dehumanizing. I'm just saying, like, I don't know, that scene with Pod where all those ladies were like coming out and contorting themselves. I thought that was pretty dehumanizing last season. I just wouldn't put it as the most.
Interesting. Yeah, no, that's a good point. That's a good point. Although, like, the way he talks with the young boy, like, Baelish's worker.
That was dominance. That was about dominance, for sure.
I guess the casualness of the whole scene, I felt like, was his way of dominating, his way of establishing dominance.
I won't argue that it was about power.
Yeah.
It definitely was about power and sexual appetite and enjoying, you know, this is how they enjoy their time together as a couple. But I don't know. Maybe I'm being too forgiving because Ober Martell is so charismatic, but I felt like his attitude towards those women was actually a bit nicer than what we've seen before. Like Baelish, I don't know, wiping one prostitute's mouth and then like shoving her towards the next customer, which is something we saw in previous seasons. It's just like,
I guess that's like just kind of like over the top. Like that's so over the top and ridiculous though that it's like it's like totally separated from my universe. You know what I'm saying? But okay. Like you know this
but
idea.
This I can relate to.
The idea of a rich, like powerful guy sort of choosing what woman he wants, you know, in a lineup, I think is far more plausible.
It was lady's choice, letting the lady choose.
There you go. Well, it's far more plausible to me anyway. But great intro, and then he totally like owns that guy in the wrist in a way that I did not see coming. Like I did not think that was how that was going to play out. So I thought that was really effective, and then Tyrion comes in, interrupts him before things escalate even further. So I thought it was a fantastic character intro. I mean, very memorable character. Obviously, attractive man with a really sexy, exotic accent. Made me really confused about my sexuality. I'll put that out there as well, you know?
Yeah, that low-cut robe he was wearing.
I know. It's just, I felt like, you know, there's all these, it stirred up all these feelings inside me that I'm still at a loss to explain. So,
you asked me in the last episode that we did, the season 4 preview, what I was looking forward to. And I said, you know, two new characters. So these are the two new characters I was talking about.
Who are the characters?
Oberyn Martell and Ilaria Sand.
His paramour.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. So yeah, great intro. Looking forward to seeing how that character is going to mix it up. And yeah, I mean, it's at this point, it's really challenging. We can talk about this at the end of the episode, Joanna, but it's really challenging to think about like who we're really rooting for at this point, right? Like, are there good guys really? I mean, I guess, Jon Snow, kind of, you know, like, do you have a character that you're sort of like Arya, right? Like, it's hard to the Starks, I guess, are the closest to pure good at this point. But even them, like, they've been so much atrocity has happened to them that like, it just feels like everyone's just seeking revenge upon revenge in this show. Like, it's hard to think of who is really doing things for pure and noble reasons anymore.
Yeah, I don't know that anyone is doing anything for, like, Sansa is just trying to survive, it seems like.
Right, yeah. So the fact that Oberyn's coming in and saying he's very clearly going to cause issues for the Lannisters.
Right.
It's hard to know who to root for because we like Tyrion, very charismatic as well. But we
don't like the Lannisters in a whole. And when he walks in and he's like, "Do you know why all the world hates a Lannister?" And we're like, "Yes, we are on your side, Oberyn. We hate the Lannisters too.
Right.
They've been huge assholes, except for Tyrion. And okay, we like Jaime. But Tywin and Cersei and Joffrey are horrible people. And so, you know, I think that is an immediate way to put us on Oberyn's side for him to be like, "I hate Lannisters." And we're like, oh.
Yeah, fair enough.
People hate Lannisters.
Also, I didn't know that Oberyn had an Irish accent, but according to your impression just now, he does.
No, that was my really dead-on Chilean accent, and okay. You should eat your words.
Fair point. Hey, one thing I also wanted to mention, like talking about Lannisters, going back to the opening scene, one thing that I thought was nice was, you know, Jaime was saying, like, why are there two swords? And Tywin was saying how, oh, well, the sword was ridiculously large. In the first place, there was more than enough metal for two swords. I like that because I felt like, and tell me if I'm just totally reading too far into this, I felt like it shows how practical of a person Tywin is. You know, most people would be like, oh, the sword, like we must maintain it for family generations. Tywin's like, it's just a bunch of metal that we can melt down and form two swords.
I have two feelings on that.
Do it.
One is that Ned's sword was like ridiculously huge. But that was kind of a point of pride. That was a family blade. And, you know, if you want to use as a metaphor for something else. Like if you have a giant sword, you're going to be proud of it but it's also a matter of disrespect to melt that down, to
right.
destroy that family blade and throw that wolf pelt on the fire is such a huge disrespect for the Stark family and their possessions. So it's not even, I think, about practicality. I think it's about disrespect.
Well, I'm not saying that disrespect wasn't part of the equation.
Right.
I'm just saying he killed two birds with one stone, perhaps, we can say. But yeah, no, good points. Good to know your perspective because it's usually accurate. I would say it's 99.9% of the time accurate. So. All right. Well, let's move on.
Should we talk a little about that conversation that Oberyn and Tyrion had about Oberyn's motivation and why he's there? Did that make sense to you?
Okay, or? Yeah. So did it make sense? I mean, it took a little while to piece together, right? The idea is that he gave a little history lesson, right? So
he did it so sexily that you didn't even notice that you were getting exposition.
That's correct. On
throat, right?
Yeah. I mean, like by the end, I was fully erect and I had no idea where I was. So, but in all seriousness, it was a little bit challenging to grasp. I think all I really took away from it was that the mountain had slain his sister. Is that right?
Yeah, and raped her.
Yeah, raped her and like split her in half, and that theoretically Tywin was the one that commanded this to happen.
Can I give you a tiny history lesson? That's
please, yeah. I think the history lesson that the show gave was a little bit inadequate. Like, it doesn't really explain how things happened. Or it does it so quickly that it's not even worth it. So, please.
So basically, Oberyn's sister, Ilya, was married to Rhaegar Targaryen, who was Dany's older brother. The last Targaryen king was King Aerys. That's who Jaime killed, and he had that whole speech about him in the hot tub last season, right? About the mad King Aerys. Rhaegar was his son, like his son and heir. And basically, Rhaegar and Oberyn's sister Ilya and their two children were living in the castle when, you know, it was overtaken by the Lannisters in the war that put Robert on the throne. So Jaime killed King Aerys. The Mountain, under Tywin's command, raped and killed Ilya and killed her children and wrapped them in Lannister cloaks as like, you know, to be as evil and disrespectful
as possible.
Yeah. So Oberyn has cause to be upset.
Why did they invite Oberyn to the wedding in the first place? Or House Martell, I should say.
Because they live in Dorne, which is, it's a political gambit. I mean, you couldn't leave them out. Their family is too important.
Right.
Their region is too important. And, you know, they didn't get involved in the War of the Five Kings. So there maybe was no reason to expect that the rancor was quite as, you know, why weren't the Martells more involved in the last war? Why weren't they eager to take down the Lannisters and that sort of thing? So, but yeah, it's a diplomacy thing. You have, you know, it's like if Obama invited Putin somewhere, it would be like worse to leave him out.
Right.
So you have to invite him, even if things aren't as warm and friendly as they should be.
Who was in power before the Targaryens?
It was the Targaryens for a long time. I don't remember right now off the top of my head.
Because I was reading, like on Twitter, someone said something along the lines of like even the Targaryens took power by might. Like
right.
it's not
they
like,
used the dragons to take the throne in the first place.
Right, exactly. Sure. So yeah. It's not like, you know, I guess it's not like there's anyone who's inherently more deserving of the throne than anyone else, right?
No. Is that fair enough? True. That's probably true of any
monarchy in the history of mankind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And please do write into A Cast of Kings and tell me how wrong I am to not remember, guys.
Yes. Please do that. For me. We got
So that's all the history. I mean, there's more there, but I liked it. It was I felt like that was a nod for the book readers. Cause you know, if you read the books, there's just chapters and chapters of that stuff of like the history of all these families and how they've interacted for years and years. So, I mean, you needed to know why Oberyn hated the Lannisters anyway, to understand what was going on, but it was nice to have that little bit of history in there. So.
We had got some more of the relationship between Tyrion and Sansa this episode.
Yes.
Sansa obviously has just been, you know, witness or, you know, recipient of devastating news upon devastating news. Presumably, I mean, we know now that she's heard about the news of the Red Wedding and how horrible it was. And Tyrion tries to make her feel better, but she is not really going to have it. I mean, and I don't really blame her. Like, Tyrion's trying to do right by her, right? Like,
yeah.
I would say, I mean, given the circumstances he's in, he's not, like, for example, raping her, which is presumably his what his dad wants him to do, right? If I recall from last season. Like, forcing her to have sex with him.
Yeah. I feel like it's so sad that in this world that's our benchmark of a good guy.
Yeah.
Well, he's not raping her.
He's not raping her. And so therefore he's probably, you know, higher up on the moral ladder than a lot of people. But not only that, I mean, he's trying to see what he can do. Like she's saying, oh, I'm having trouble sleeping. And he's like, well, I can get you drugs. Basically, I can figure out a way to get you to sleep faster. And she's just having none of it. Then she has this interesting encounter with Ser Dantos in the forest. I mean, I actually thought that given the conversation that Brienne and Jaime had right before this, that there was going to be some negative thing going on.
Well, it was also set up very strangely.
Right.
It was like a horror movie where she's being like pursued, you know, in the hedges or whatever. So
I just want you to know that I saw this episode twice. The first time I saw it, I actually did not see the previously on, and I still remembered who Ser Dantos was from.
Oh, nice! Good job. Earlier.
Yeah, and how she spared his life. But I actually, my first inclination was that something horrible was going to happen. Even after it was clearly him, like, I didn't know if some person had hired him or something like that. But that was a very sweet scene. Like, even when he gave her the crystals, I was like, are these like poison crystals? Like, are they going to like melt her clothes? But it ended up being just, a really, really sad man who'd lost everything wanting to thank her for sparing his life. And it ultimately ended up being, you know, really sweet. And, as a result of that, what did you think of this scene?
I can never repay you. You gave me my life. But this is worth more than my life. It belongs to my mother and her mother before her. House Hollard was strong once. House on the rise. That's all that's left of those days, thanks to a few sad, fat drunks like me.
I can't take it. It's very, very kind of you, but I can't.
I don't have anything else left. That's all. Take it. Wear it. Let my name have one more moment in the sun before it disappears from the world.
Yeah, I really liked it. I was glad it was in there. I think a lot of the book readers were thinking it wasn't going to be in because, you know, Sir Dontus showed up and then he disappeared. And we're like, okay, well, there's probably – he's not coming back. But why introduce him at all? It was really confusing. So,
I mean, I think that, like, in a show like this, there – I mean, just take this episode. There is so little that's not incredibly bleak or violent, right? And maybe they just wanted to put something in there that was – sort of showed you that there is still goodness in this universe. Do you buy that? Or do you have the? Can you not comment, Jonah Robinson?
I thought it was a really lovely scene, and I think one thing that I think is really clear for those of us who've rewatched the seasons recently is how much Sophie Turner has grown up as an actress. You know, I thought she was really, like, Sansa's so graceful in that scene, and I thought she was just really lovely and sold it so well. And it's not that, you know, she was bad in the past. I just feel like she's been making leaps and bounds. That Maisie Williams as Arya was always great, and that Sophie Turner as Sansa has become great. And I think that's really highlighted in this scene, so...
A couple of other things we just want to mention before we take a quick break. One of them is we forgot to mention like this really terrible conversation that Joffrey has with Jaime. Joffrey doesn't want Jaime to be his guard for whatever variety of reasons. Like he doesn't want someone who doesn't have one hand. And
Joffrey is such a little shit.
Yeah,
man.
He's really, really irritating in this episode, and mm-hmm. like masterfully played, but still very irritating, and like such a dick to his brother slash father, right?
Uncle slash father. Right.
They know I saved the city. They know I won the war.
The war's not won, but while Stannis lives,
I broke Stannis on the Blackwater. I pity you weren't there to help, Uncle.
My apologies, Your Grace. I was rather busy.
Busy getting captured. So this is the famous Book of Brothers. All the great deeds of all the great kings go out there. It's Arthur Dayne. The Sword of the Morning. Led the attack on the Kingswood Brotherhood. Defeated the Smiling Knight in single combat. Sir Duncan the Tall. 4 pages for Sir Duncan. He must have been quite a man.
So they say.
Sir Jaime Lannister. Hmm? Someone forgot to write down all your great deeds.
There's still time.
Is there? For a 40-year-old knight with one hand? How can you protect me with that?
I use my left hand now, Your Grace. Makes for more of a contest.
It's really painful to see. And then Jaime like doesn't lose his temper, always has his cool, right? And doesn't react to any of Joffrey's barbs. Kind of, and there's that scene where he like slams the book shut. You know, a lot of potential meaning from his movement of slamming the book shut, right? Like this idea that he's like angry, he's saying like, you know, F this, like F this book for not, or, you know, perhaps he's more angry at himself for not having more accomplishments in the book. Or he's saying, I'm not going to think about this for a while. What is your interpretation of that?
I think it's frustration with Joffrey, really. I mean, the book is the Book of the Brothers. And it's just like a really sacred text for the Kingsguard.
Yep.
And Jaime has before mentioned, you know, a lot in the show they mentioned growing up idolizing these certain knights. Like Sir Barristan Selmy, who's now with Dany, like people talk about how they read about his deeds. And so for Joffrey to show so much contempt in general for what Jaime has done with his life, that was my read on that. And I want to say really quickly that there's a really cute nod in that scene. Joffrey mentions Sir Duncan as one of the knights that he mentions, and that's George R. R. Martin has written Duncan Egg, which is a story of Sir Duncan. It's like a side companion piece to the Song of Ice and Fire. So it was like a cute little shout out of like, ah, oh, here are some stories about this knight. And right. George R. R. Martin has written that book. But anyway, like back to your question, my read on that is Jaime's barely contained rage at Joffrey, at how he could have raised such a monster. I don't know.
Interesting. All right, yeah, we had very different interpretations of that scene. So,
but no, you're right that it probably is also some frustration with his lot in life.
There's some self-loathing potentially going on there.
Yeah, in some way. Potential.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. All right. So I think that covers most of the stuff that went on in King's Landing. I mean, there's also a scene with like Brienne shows up, right, and it gets in good with Margaery.
I love that because Lady Olenna, the Queen of Thorns, was like, "You're a magnificent creature." Like that was just so lovely to have Brienne admired in that way. Because she is. She's awesome.
And, right, and there was a callback to, I want to say, season two, where Brienne was first introduced and she kicked
Loras's
ass.
Yeah.
That's something that I just felt like was really skillful throughout the course of this episode, or depending on how you look at it, incredibly confusing, that they just called back to so many things that had happened throughout the show. It felt like they're really sort of creating a universe and like with a rich history that we, the viewers, are now a part of.
And also this very gracious scene between Margaery and Brienne, where Margaery could blame Brienne for Renly's death, because a lot of people do. And Margaery's like, no, you know, I know you loved him. Like, okay.
So. Right. Yeah. We also should point out, by the way, that Jaime has here's a question I've been waiting since I saw the episode to ask you. But Jaime has been given a metal hand. And I was wondering, is that true in the book or not?
Yes.
Oh, it is. Okay. Mm-hmm. The reason I ask is because this actually happens quite frequently in movies and TV shows, where a character will get limbs cut off and then be given a prosthetic limb. You know, whether like, okay, I guess the example that immediately leapt to mind was Titus, the film based on Titus Andronicus, mm-hmm. Where one of the characters' hands gets cut off and then is given like wooden hands. And the reason for the wooden hands is, I don't think that was actually in the play Titus Andronicus. I think it was actually
to make the CG
easier. To, yeah. Right. So you don't need to CG out their hand the whole time.
Yeah.
So I didn't know if that was something that the showrunners did to make their lives easier or if that was actually in the book, but it's in the book.
Yes.
Go ahead. Can you say something?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Well, thank you for answering that question, John Robinson. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
All right. So, let's move on. Before we do that though, we gotta, thank some people, John Robinson, that made this podcast possible. Every year, the last couple of years, we've been kickstarting the Cast of Kings podcast. And we ask you guys to contribute a little money, but in return, everyone can listen to this show for free. Every single episode this season, somebody contributed enough money to be a sponsor of the episode. And our first sponsor of the year is a Kickstarter project called Film Critic the Movie, which is based on the best-selling book Film Critic. And it's a feature film adaptation in the grand tradition of Christopher Guest meets Calvin and Hobbes. If that doesn't sell you, then whatever you found funny in life, from brunch to budgetary reforms, know that this will be exactly that. Your funny bone will be crazy tickled. And all you need to do is contribute some money. And some money isn't even all that much. Some money is really negligible when you stop to really think about it. At this point, pause to let them think about it. Oh, wait, I'm not supposed to read that. So if you like movies or comedy or criticism or Matthew McConaughey, you're going to want to get fully behind this Kickstarter project. Again, that's Film Critic the Movie, because we're not going to play by their rules anymore. Also, Matthew McConaughey is not really involved in the production of this movie. We didn't mean to give that impression. So anyway, and I'm going to stop reading from here. But yeah, this is a Kickstarter project by a colleague of ours named Laramie. I've done a bunch of podcasts with Laramie in the past. He's a really nice guy. You can find this project by going to Kickstarter.com and searching for the term Film Critic. And again, it's Film Critic the Movie. It is a Kickstarter project for a sort of mockumentary about the lives of film critics, which I think we all know, Jonah Robinson, is an inherently silly profession. I mean, the idea that there's people out there who think other people care about what they think about movies and TV shows is kind of absurd, if you ask
me. Oh, God, and like subject them to either reading about it or, God forbid, listening to it for any stretch of time.
I know. It's ridiculous.
Appalling.
I mean, it's insane that we live in a world where this is the case. Why not make a movie based on this premise? Check it out at Kickstarter.com and just go to Film Critic. It's called Film Critic the Movie by Laramie, and also based on a book called Film Critic, where Laramie, who's been a film critic for a decade, writes about his wacky experiences as a film critic. So check that stuff out. Thanks to Laramie and Film Critic the Movie for sponsoring us for this episode. Thanks also to the following people who contributed $10 to have their names read by us. Now, I solicited your names via Kickstarter, and I also asked you guys to do pronunciation guide. And based on the pronunciation guides people sent in, I've come to one of two possible conclusions. Number one, pronunciation guides are really difficult to do. Or number two, you listeners are really terrible at making pronunciation guides.
Because or number three, they just like to mess with us.
Exactly. I think that's entirely possible. All right. So let's do this thing, Jonah Robinson. Thanks to the following people: Ian Fay, Angus Ho, Jessica Pippin, Keith Lobin, Shurin Mother of Cats De Silva, or actually Suren Mother of Cats De Silva. He's a guy, but apparently Father of Cats doesn't have the same ring to it. Jeff Villamil, Ryan Silberstein, Ted Boris, Pete Zoroka, and Lee Cooper. Thank you guys so much for your donations.
And I want to thank Jonathan Schwartz, Enola Z, Dean Tisthammer, Mark Cole, Josh Pierstorf, Corey Stark, Raving Mad Lasker, my personal favorite, John Paul Lawrence, Carter Rogers, Robin Suter, Tanner Celan from Cologne, Germany, who wanted me to butcher that, and Vince Maroney, or you can find him on Twitter at TweedleVee. So thank you guys so much, and an extra special thanks to Laramie, who is the greatest guy in the whole world. So check out his Kickstarter. I co-sign that.
Definitely. All right. Let's move on, guys. So a few more plot lines to discuss, Jonah Robinson. When we last left off with Jon Snow and Ygritte, they were not on good terms. Ygritte fired a bunch of arrows into him. We actually discussed this point about whether or not she intentionally didn't kill him. And that is apparently made unambiguously clear in this episode, right? That she her targeting is apparently so good that if she missed, it had to be on purpose. So
that's the implication.
That's the implication, right? And so then we see actually, I believe it's some new wildlings, right? These guys, these cannibals, are technically wildlings.
The Fens, yeah.
Right, the Fens, and they have gotten some crow meat from the south of the wall. Is that the correct? Right.
That's what I understood.
Yeah. And so interesting because like we saw like that giant in Season 3, Episode 1, but we haven't really seen that many people north of the wall, like different kinds of people north of the wall. So these guys were pretty interesting. Like, just the character design, it looked like they had these gigantic, intricate scars all over their face, right?
Yeah, that guy looked awesome.
Yeah, so really great character design, really threatening, and apparently they're cannibals, which makes them even worse.
So they're not cannibals in the book.
Oh, interesting.
And so I think it really speaks to your point where I think they were really trying to create this sense of other.
Right.
North of the wall that we hadn't, you know, like Ygritte and Tormund are just sort of like dirty redheads who wear furs, but right. We like them, you know. And yeah, we saw the warg last season who died. But yeah, just really creating this sense of menace and other and these things that are coming. And yeah, like you said, we saw a giant before, but these Thens, they were great. They meant business. So
there is a scene actually. So in the last episode, I was talking about how disappointed I was that we didn't see more of Mance Rayder. Well, apparently like Mance Rayder's absence is actually a plot point in this episode, right? Where they're basically – they don't know if he's actually going to follow through with the plan. Is that – did I read that correct? Like it had been so long since he lit this fire that they were not even sure that it was going to happen.
Are you talking about Tormund and the Thens aren't sure?
Right, right.
Yeah. I think that's accurate.
It remains.
And there's this. I mean, the whole time there's this concern of like, can the various tribes north of the Wall work together? And I think this really highlighted, you know, this tension between, you know, the Fen leader and Ygritte, and between the Fen leader and Tormund, and just sort of, they're not a united force against Castle Black. So.
Right.
And they really need Mance Rayder to bring them together if he is indeed going to do that.
So. Right. Because he was saying how he only, you know, takes orders from Mance and from no one else. Right.
Right. And I mean, the reason that everyone south of the Wall laughs off this prospect of a northern invasion is because the north is so known for not getting along. And so No way could anyone unite them to pose a credible threat.
Right.
And so here's Mance has theoretically done it. But yeah, if he's not on the scene, sort of smoothing these interactions over, then what's going to happen?
We shall see. We shall see.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see what else happens. So we see Jon Snow. He makes it back to Castle Black, apparently recovered totally from all the arrow wounds, and has this amazing scene in front of the Castle Black Council, I guess, where he has to defend himself, and he gives a full recounting of what happened. Obviously, he killed Corrin Halfhand. That was going to create an awkward situation no matter what. He definitely... All right, so someone actually wrote in. I think it was Pat that wrote in saying how they believe that I probably hated this scene because of how half-assed the season 2 plotline with Jon Snow was. I actually thought it was pretty good, and when he gives that guy what's coming to him with the "you must not have been very good at your job," that was just an awesome line delivered well. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
Yeah, I haven't heard as like I think Jon Snow has been a point of contention on the show, and a lot of people do not like what's been done with him or haven't really responded well to Kit Harington. But I've heard nothing but praise for this scene, and this is like a new, invigorated Jon Snow that we can believe in. And I agree with that. I thought it was a great scene.
Yeah, I mean, he totally established that he knows what he's doing, and he's trying to work for the best. And yeah, sure, he may have broke a few rules. He may have violated his sacred oath. But hey, you know, it was all for the greater good. So
there's a difference between sneaking off to the Molestown brothel and sleeping with the enemy.
While we sit here debating which rules I broke, Mance Rayder marches on the Wall with an army of 100,000.
Impossible. You can't get 50 wildlings together before they start killing each other.
100,000 is united the Thens, the Hornfoots, the Ice River clans. He has giants fighting for
him. Giants?
Have you ever been beyond the Wall, sir?
I commanded the city watch of King's Landing, boy.
And now you're here. You must not have been very good at your job.
How dare you!
There's a band of wildlings south of the Wall already, led by Tormund Giantsbane. I killed their warg and three others. They shot me full of arrows. The orders are to attack Castle Black from the south when Mance hits it from the north. The signal for the attack will be a bonfire. Mance said it would be the greatest fire the North has ever seen.
Oh, I read a really interesting comment somewhere on some message board saying that, you know, all the scenes north of the Wall were filmed in Iceland. And there was this theory that conditions were so harsh and inhuman in Iceland that just to get any kind of performance out was an effort. And so now that the characters are, I mean, they were back in Ireland, south of the Wall last season a bit, but you know, just that maybe they were so cold and miserable that that's why that those sequences lacked energy.
Oh yeah, you're right. That's gotta be it. That has to be the reason.
It could have affected it.
Yeah, no, for sure. For sure.
I'm not saying it's the only reason. I'm just saying it couldn't have been easy. I think Rose Leslie, who played Ygritte, did a great job being very energetic in those sequences, but maybe Kit Harington just needed a little more pampering,
yeah,
some more hair products, and he's doing well. So.
It is just it is a situation where, like, seeing Jon Snow back in this setting, it is, in fact, wildly implausible, the whole plan, right? I mean, hearing him say it out loud, I did find it to be why, like, if I were on the other side of the table, I would have had a hard time believing it. If I were, what's his name? Alistair Thorne. I would, like, and I already hated Jon Snow, I would find it completely unbelievable. So,
yeah. There's also that scene with Sam and Jon where Jon talks about Rob, you know, that seeing the aftermath of the Red Wedding, you know, its impact on Jon Snow was part of this episode,
right,
too.
Right. And what'd you think of that?
I thought it was, I liked it. I mean, I don't think they did a great job selling us on the Rob and Jon relationship in the first episode, but everyone was so young and they were just getting started. It's really hard. This setup is so hard because they had that like one episode or episode and a half to establish these relationships before everyone's sort of blown to the winds for the rest of the series. And you're like, okay, I'm supposed to believe that these people really care about each other, but we haven't seen them together very much. So,
speaking of being blown to the winds, it's interesting which plot lines didn't show up in this episode, right? So we didn't see any of Theon.
Mm-hmm.
When Yara, like, presumably Yara is going to try and get him back. So that has yet to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And no Stannis, right? No Davos, no Red Witch.
No Bran.
So, no Bran, right? Oh, totally missed that. No Hodor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's it, right? Those are the only plot lines we didn't see this episode, right?
Yeah.
Couple more plot lines to cover off on John Robinson. Two more. One of them is what's going on with Dany. So they're going to Meereen. And why are they going to Meereen again?
Because it's another slaver city. And sort of Dany has taken it upon herself to free all of the slaves.
Right.
And amass an army. I mean, give them the option to fight with her if they want to.
And what was up with all the dead people on the signs?
They're slaves on the signposts on the way.
But so I guess, like, were they just like there by default? Like, they weren't there for Dany? Like, were they
there to send a message?
Yeah, were they there to send a message to Dany, or they just happened to? That just Meereen just likes nailing slaves to these signs.
Who doesn't? I don't think so. I could be wrong. Please do write in if I'm wrong. But I think they were just there.
All right. And she had this little nice scene where she flirted with Dario, and Dario's like, look, you got to, if you want to be a part of the people, you have to know what the names of these gorgeous flowers that I'm handing to you are.
Yeah.
So what would you think of that?
I have book reader thoughts that I can't really say.
Okay. All right. I like how you refer to your thoughts as like dirty thoughts if they're book reader thoughts. I have book reader thoughts.
I dare not mention that.
I dare not. So...
But the dragon, I mean, we should talk about the dragons, though.
Yeah, they're all grown up, and they are very difficult to tame, apparently, right? So we shall see. I think they look great.
Yes.
Like, from a CG standpoint, I think they're fantastic. So,
and that shot of the, like, lamb or whatever dropping from the sky was pretty bonkers. So.
She may not be able to control them, but can she harness them, I think will be the question, right? She may not be able to tame them.
Can you parse the difference between control and harness?
Well, just like she may not be able to like get them to do exactly as she commands, but she may be able to direct their energy. She may be able to. It's like a gigantic gun. You may not be able to like control how powerful it is, but you may be able to point it in the right direction.
Okay.
So that's. I think that's probably the tension they're setting up there. If I had to surmise, say nothing, Joanna. Say nothing. All right, and the only other plot line we have to discuss is Arya, right?
The only thing we have left to discuss is the best thing that happened in the episode.
Okay. So, I actually do want to talk to you about this because I do have thoughts, and they may not be what you expect.
Oh, no.
So, a lot of people tweeted, and they said, man, I wish I could have been around when Dave watched this episode because the history is me, Dave Chen, I've been complaining so long about, man, when are they going to – they keep teasing Arya doing stuff. When is she finally going to do stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they have this amazing scene with the Hound where they're talking with, like, these rapist, like, monsters. And, you know, what I love is, you know, like, the Hound knows he has to fake as though Arya is his sex slave or something like that. Even though there's this kind of bizarre sort of purity to their relationship, right? This bizarre purity between the Hound and the Stark girls, you know, like he never makes a move on them or anything like that.
He just calls her a cunt, but other than that.
Right. But he never we return to our definition of a good guy in the land of Westeros.
That's which is true. There's
someone who
no
doesn't
raping.
Rape someone. Yeah. And so he doesn't force himself on them, and there's but he understands that he needs to pretend that he is in order to fit in with the cool cats. And this is an amazing sequence because it lasts forever in the realm of even by Game of Thrones standards, it lasted quite a while. And whenever a dialogue sequence lasts for a long time, you know that something horrible is probably going to happen. I mean, just the way that a scene like this is able to build tension, anytime a dialogue scene happens for too long, you just know something is not right as the viewer, right? And so it led up to awesome fight scene. We shot really interestingly, with some really wide angle close up shots in a way that I felt was rare in this series. Mm-hmm. And then concluded with Arya quoting those lines at that guy who earlier in the show killed a boy, right? Killed her friend with her own sword. So what are your thoughts on this scene?
I thought it was great. and I too thought you would be pleased because you've been waiting for psychotic Arya to show her true colors. You were not pleased?
Okay, so I was pleased, but I was pleased until the very last couple shots of this episode. If you recall, she's talking about she wants a horse and she wants something to drink and eat, and then the last shots are of her riding into the distance with the Hound, and the triumphant main theme of Game of Thrones playing in the background. I'm actually, John, I was actually thinking of putting together a video essay where I would, my perspective is that what music the creators choose to put under a scene informs you what their thoughts on that scene are.
Oh, who's the good guy?
Right, who's a good guy, and what is the order? What's the order of things in the universe here?
How are you supposed to be feeling about this?
Exactly, and they played it. They played this triumphant music, this is supposed to be amazing, and I know a lot of people felt that it was amazing.
I think you're supposed to find it a little disturbing, though, too.
I mean, I found it incredibly disturbing.
Yeah,
that she, her giving into her vengeful fantasies. Is incredibly compelling, but I don't know that I wanted to feel this is amazing. Go Arya, it's awesome that you've done this. I don't know that that's how I wanted to feel. I think I wanted to see that happen just because it feels like it should, in order for the universe to be sort of restored to its rightful place, she needs to get her vengeance. In a lot of movies, when people get their vengeance, a lot of TV shows, when people get their vengeance, it's usually an empty exercise, right? It's rarely a thing where they get revenge and it's like, oh, everything's okay now. It's usually they get their vengeance and, wow, I need to deal with a whole boatload of psychological issues now. Or, wow, the vengeance that I got created a whole new set of problems for me, which is going to have to force me to kill more people. That kind of thing. And the way the show played it off is this is hey, we're supposed to be cheering in triumph, and this is the great order of things in the Game of Thrones universe. I mean, we just watched a girl brutally murder a dude, in a really graphic and painful way. He died probably a very slow death. And I did not feel good being completely triumphal in my reception of that scene. So that's my kind of rant on the situation. What are your thoughts?
Honestly, I think they're not to spoil anything about another show we did a podcast about, but if you bring it back to Breaking Bad, there are those people who would just cheer for Walter White. And
this character doing bad things, you're saying, right?
The bad fan, right? The bad fan who watches the show that's supposed to be telling a nuanced story of the decaying, effects of, our baser feelings. But they're just reading it on a very surface level of seeing oh yeah, Arya's kicking ass. And I mean, there's part of us that have to be glad to see a Stark not be a victim. But at the same time, yeah, I don't think we're supposed to see this little girl. And in the book, she's 11. We're not supposed to see this little girl and be really excited that she has been put in a position where she has to kill people.
Right.
But
I think in the show, like, the show is trying to make it seem like you are supposed to be, right? Okay, I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
That's okay, but I disagree with your interpretation. I hear what you're saying about the theme rising, but I think the way the camera lingered on her, like, little smile, I don't think they're trying to paint it as, isn't this great? It's like when...
Go ahead. Anyway. I'm sorry. I keep interrupting. Go ahead.
No. I keep wanting to talk about Breaking Bad, but I shouldn't. So anyway.
I mean, Joanna, let me do this video essay. And I mean, it'll be like very brief, but I'll just take that scene and I'll put different music under it. And it's just like, I think it'll be night and day in terms of how you feel about Arya's arc, right? When you watch it. And I think I would, wager money that the vast majority of people left that scene feeling like really good about the state of Arya. And I didn't feel that way. And I thought the show was trying to make me feel something that I wasn't feeling, you know?
Right. So and I disagree.
I had a little cognitive dissonance there. So
yeah. And I hear what you're saying and I see how you got there, but I disagree with you.
Okay.
Because I don't think that the showrunners, their understanding of the books are deep enough that, I mean, if you recall the scene from last year when Arya is sitting by the fire and she's talking about the revenge she wants, I mean, you're supposed to be creeped out by that, by this little girl and her and the way that her world has been warped. And I think the way the camera lingered on her little smile after she killed Polliver, I think you're supposed to be a little unsettled by it. It really, it's a harder sell because Maisie Williams is older than Arya is.
Right.
You know,
right.
So
like if she was truly 11 years old, then
right.
That would indeed be frightening. Right.
Super creepy.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But I just don't agree with you that the show is entirely trying to sell this as a heroic moment. Mm. I think they're trying to sell you a mixed message, which is the more interesting message.
I agree. But I think I agree that that is the most interesting message. But I disagree that that's what the show is trying to do. So like I think we're
this is the first time we've ever disagreed
ever in the history of this podcast. So
and it's going to be the last.
And it will be the last. So there is no next week's episode, guys. Okay, and I think that covers this week's episode, right, Joanna?
Yeah.
So overall, what'd you think? Do you like this episode?
I loved it. I really loved it. I think it was bookended with such strong plots between Oberyn and Arya. And by leaving out some of the less dynamic characters like Bran or Stannis, it just gave us a really strong opening to the season.
Yeah, I agree. I think it was a great opening episode, and looking forward to more. So I think that's going to bring us to the end of this week's episode, yeah? Let's wrap it up for this week's Cast of Kings. Thanks again for all the Kickstarter backers. Really appreciate it, and look forward to sharing more thoughts on Game of Thrones in the weeks to come. Joanna Robinson, where can people find more of your work on the internet this week?
You can find me over on vanityfair.com, or you can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This.
Find me at Dave Chensky on Twitter. That's Dave Chen, SKY, and at davechen.net. Thanks for listening. We'll see you guys next week.